Most youth feel that they have no future here. They cannot make the amount of money that they would make doing a manual labor job in, say, Qatar or Saudi Arabia. They cannot make the same amount of money working even a decent job or a white collar job here in Nepal. So that resentment has been building. Even students feel that they cannot get a job here in Nepal, so they choose to migrate to foreign lands immediately upon graduating high school or graduating college.
I want to thank you so
So
much,
that is.
Pranay. We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue these discussions because this regional context is so important. Pranay Rana is a writer and journalist based in Kathmandu, Nepal. And as we wrap up our broadcast, the late breaking news on the murder of the conservative activist Charlie Kirk. CNN's confirmed law enforcement has a man in custody who confessed to his father about shooting Kirk. The father reportedly told authorities and said he had secured his son until he could be formally detained. This morning, President Trump said on Fox News, quote, somebody very close to him turned him in. The person was involved with law enforcement, what was a person of faith, a minister, and brought him to a U.S. Marshal who was fantastic. They drove him to the police headquarters, and he's there now, Trump said. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
It's time to make your voice heard and your impact matter. Join us for our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $45,000 goal by September 20th.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, three Oregon Democratic senators get bomb threats.
Protesters approach a 100-day milestone at the ICE facility in southwest Portland.
And immigrant rights groups in Washington press for stronger privacy laws.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 12th, 2025. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to encourage you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Three leading Oregon senators received bomb threats to their homes on Thursday. The false claims about explosives waiting in their home mailboxes were received by email that morning. Senate President Rob Wagner, Senate Majority Leader Casey Jama, and Senate President Pro Tem James Manning Jr. were the senior Senate Democrats who received the threats. Jama and Manning are the state's only African-American representatives. Oregon State Police Lieutenant Casey Hegney said explosive technicians responded to all three reports and, quote, all threats were determined to be false and no explosive devices were located, end quote. The threats were made the day after conservative activist Charlie Kirk was killed at Utah Valley University on Wednesday.
Portlanders protesting the ICE facility on Southwest McAdam are nearing their 100th day of continuous protest this Sunday. KBOO's Althea Billings spoke with two of the protesters to learn more.
I'm Grace. I go by Gray down at the ICE protest on McAdam. I'm one of the protest medics.
Hi, I'm Vanetta, and I am someone who's adamant about protecting these protesters down at the McAdams ICE facility.
First, I wanted to ask about what each of your experiences have been at the ICE facility. Vanetta, you came down more recently to those protests.
Oh, yeah. My first impression was meeting Gray and the fact that she had no voice virtually. She couldn't talk because of her exposure to the tear gas and pepper ball chemical that exists down there now. My next impression was that there was a great group of peacefully protesting people down there in no way breaking the law, and DHS and ICE are coming out of the building and attacking these people. And I just find this to be unacceptable on any level.
For me, it's been different being a protest medic. My first time down there was actually the day before No Kings, and I went after work in my scrubs, not really knowing what to expect. I walked up onto the driveway and immediately got shot at. So that was a, you know, eye-opening experience. Then the next day was No Kings, and I was there, and I went to the 5051 march, which was peaceful, families, and night and day when comparison to the protest at ICE. When I got to the protest after the 5051 march, down at ICE, I felt like I was in a war zone. And it wasn't because of protesters. It was because of ICE and DHS. They were shooting canister after canister, pepper ball after pepper ball. And at that time, I didn't know that they shot ballistic missile marking beanbags. And people were there protesting. All the people that were there, they weren't armed. They weren't even had protective gear on. I myself didn't even have, all I had was an N9. And when the gases started, I immediately had to run because it hit my respiratory so hard that I started to not be able to breathe, gagging, and then vomiting to the point that I started bleeding. And after that day, I took 2 days off to recover and have been back since. And it's been very interesting to be a medic down there. You know, we take care of our own, because no one else is going to do it for us.
What motivates you to continue to show up?
What motivates me and what motivates pretty much every person on the ground is our communities are being targeted. Our families, our friends, you know, our neighbors are being targeted. Immigrants, we get the job done. We make this country great. Immigrants has been at the formation of this country, yet they're being targeted with such malice and brutality. Like, how can you stand by and not do something, not use your voice?
I want to ask about the role that the ongoing 24-hour protest plays in terms of deterring ICE and how the community is responding to the increased action that ICE is doing. What is the benefit, I guess, of the ongoing protest?
Having our presence on the ground allows us to say how many people are being taken in those GEO vans that leave and go to the concentration camp in Tacoma, because that's what it is. It's a detention center, but let's be real. It's a concentration camp. So we are marking how many people are going in, also to their appointments, and who aren't coming back out. So that way, other organizations like PERC, groups that are working with immigrants, and especially detained immigrants, have that knowledge of what is actually happening and what to look out for and who to look out for. Taking on the brunt of a lot of the attention of ICE, because if they're focusing on us, they're not as much in the community. That's one of the ways they're using their resources, is by focusing on us, by us being down there.
What would be your ask of the community right now?
My ask would be, obviously, for local leaders to start paying attention, to stop giving lip service, to take this seriously, the protesters, the abuse they're experiencing. Take it seriously and start doing something about it. Listen to the protesters.
So Sunday is our 100 day of protests down at ICE, and we would love for everybody in the community to come and use your voice to stand with us, because it's very much needed. You know, our numbers may be small, but we have a lot of heart because we believe in what we're doing is right. And we would love for our community, for all of Portland, to come out and to be a part of it, to take a stand on what is happening here in the U.S. Never in my life would I would have imagined that I would be a combat medic on U.S. soil. But here we are, and that is what is happening.
Gray and Vanetta, thank you so much for talking with me today. I appreciate it.
Anytime, thank you.
That was KBOO's Althea Billings speaking with Portland protest medic Gray and protester Vanetta.
After some Washingtonians' personal information was shared with the Department of Homeland Security in order to aid in their deportation efforts, immigrant rights advocates say the state needs stronger privacy laws. Two agencies that shared that data, Apple Health and the Department of Licensing, are not covered by Washington's so-called sanctuary laws. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Immigrant rights advocates are calling on lawmakers to strengthen Washington state's privacy laws after state agencies shared personal information with the Department of Homeland Security. The information shared includes names, addresses, and immigration status, and has been collected from Washington's Medicaid program, Apple Health, and the Department of Licensing. Katie Dong with the Washington State Budget and Policy Center calls the move a violation of privacy that undermines democracy.
This data sharing is to sow fear. It's to advance Trump's mass deportation agenda that has widespread implications on immigrant families and all of our collective safety in Washington state.
Washington is a sanctuary state, meaning state law enforcement does not work with ICE or other federal agencies on immigration cases. However, Dong says the state's legislation has loopholes that are being exploited by the Trump administration. Dong adds that advocates for immigrant rights are working to strengthen the Keep Washington Working Act, the state's landmark sanctuary law that passed in 2019.
We have found that there are some challenges in enforcing the law. We are hoping to look into ways of amending the law to strengthen it and truly keep families and communities together.
Along with making the law more enforceable, Dong says immigrant rights advocates are beginning conversations with lawmakers to give people more control over their personal data. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Utah's governor calls for peace after the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, while experts warn of rising strife. Advocates push New York lawmakers to act on federal budget cuts, and Congress faces a fight over a plan for mass killings of owls. Well, that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is a political assassination. We are celebrating 250 years of the founding of this great nation. We are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. The first one of those is life.
Utah Governor Spencer Cox calls the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk on a university campus a dark day for his state, a tragic day for the nation, and a direct attack on democratic values. Authorities continue to search for the shooter who struck while Kirk was engaging students in debate. One former Utah governor calls the shooting, quote, jarring, saying it cuts to the heart of a typically peaceful community. Several historically black colleges received threats and went into lockdown after Kirk's death. After the attempted assassinations of President Donald Trump, some Republicans blamed Democrats for calling Trump a Nazi. Democrats responded that many on the right even call vaccine and campus speech policies fascist. Trump himself described his political opponents as, quote, vermin, called them far more sinister than international enemies, and said they would have to be totally rooted out. Colorado officials say a 16-year-old student who opened fire at Evergreen High School was radicalized by an unnamed extremist network. Two classmates remain in critical condition. New York advocates are pushing Governor Kathy Hochul to call a special legislative session to respond to deep cuts from the federal tax and budget mega bill. Rebecca Garrard with Citizen Action of New York warns slashing Medicaid could overwhelm the healthcare system.
Hospital closures, healthcare staff, job losses in the most immediate term. There should be emergency relief for rural hospitals and for the ability to maintain staffing.
The state faces a $3 billion shortfall from Medicaid to Head Start and SNAP. Advocates also want lawmakers to pass a long-stalled proposal to restrict cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration agents. A debate is brewing in Congress over the fate of barred owls. Wayne Pacelli with Animal Wellness Action says lawmakers are moving to review a Fish and Wildlife Service plan to shoot nearly 500,000 birds to protect an endangered species they compete with, the northern spotted owl.
If we don't stop it, it will be the largest slaughter of birds of prey that any government has ever initiated in the world. And we think it's inhumane, it's unworkable, and it has a price tag of $1.35 billion.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Rhetorical attacks across the political spectrum have escalated after the shocking murder of conservative activist Charlie Kirk on a Utah University campus on Wednesday. But the polarized responses are not new, and new research shows that they are significantly influenced by the media people choose to consume. Roz Brown has more.
Inflammatory rhetoric continues to escalate following this week's shocking death of a conservative Republican activist, and a sociologist says media consumption plays a big role. Research by Purdue University professor Marcus Mann shows Republicans and Democrats have gotten further and further apart in their worldview, which has led media consumers to seek out those who agree with them. Mann notes much of what was traditional, neutral news reporting has been replaced by opinion, or in some cases, outrage-based programming.
That kind of us versus them mentality is incredibly compelling, and it's very powerful for fostering strong in-groups and making you feel part of a strong community. And we see media outlets gaining audience share through this kind of thing.
Right-wing political activist and media personality Charlie Kirk was killed with a shot from a high-powered rifle on a Utah college campus Wednesday. After a 30-hour manhunt, officials identified and arrested the person accused in the fatal shooting as 22-year-old Utah resident Tyler Robinson. In terms of party affiliation, Mann says Republicans are more homogeneous than Democrats, sharing similar religious beliefs, race, ethnicity, and ideology. Democrats, on the other hand, are a more diverse coalition with shared policy goals. His study shows mainstream media outlets aim to report facts and cover a wide range of issues, while right-wing sites focus on a narrow set of topics and work to reinforce beliefs among a specific demographic. He says if you want your viewpoints reinforced, you know which channels to watch.
Right-wing media has become much more successful than left-wing media. It commands a way larger audience, and it has features that invoke features of religion compared to left-wing media.
Mann says polarization has always existed in journalism, but the advent of cable television and its 24/7 news cycle increased opinion-based programming, in part because it's cheaper to produce than traditional news reporting. As social isolation increases and society becomes more secular, Mann says he doesn't see the intense level of polarization changing soon. I'm Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a new member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after the newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 59. Tomorrow, will be sunshine with a high of 80. Today in history, in 2013, NASA confirms its Voyager 1 probe has become the first man-made object to enter interstellar space. It was first launched in 1977. The probe's extended mission is expected to continue to return scientific data until at least this year, with a max lifespan of 2030. The quote of the day is from Polish satirist Stanisław Lem, who said, quote, "He who has had has been, but he who hasn't been has been had."
A former motel in Wyoming has been repurposed for the Northern Arapaho Reentry Program, helping people who were recently incarcerated return home to the Wind River Reservation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. We recently talked to clients of the Northern Arapaho Reentry Program, which is helping people return home from out-of-state federal prisons and state incarceration to the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, the reservation's home to the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes. Many clients in the program say they're more confident now to stay out of incarceration with the program's assistance. Today, we'll hear from partners of the reentry program. Terry Smith, the program's administrator, is a former Northern Arapaho tribal attorney and judge who says she connects with her clients on a deeper level after she went through a public downfall a few years ago due to drugs. This day, she's picking up clients and driving them to appointments. She helps people with transportation find jobs and find benefits.
I feel like this is just perfect for me. Like I've been in their position, right?
I just want them to know that what they did and who they were before isn't who they have to be now. Our goal is for them to be self-sufficient so they can live a healthy life for themselves and their kids.
The reentry program works with other organizations like Eagles Hope, located in the town of Riverton, offering two-year sober transitional living. The facility is a former motel with 18 rooms with plans to expand. Devin Anderson is executive director of Eagles Hope.
A lot of landlords don't want to deal with felons. We have been working closely with Terry on housing her people. We have one guy here that is just, he's a really fine example of what someone can do for themselves. He came here. He has a lot of medical issues. Terry helped him with his rental fees, a lot of driving him around. We're all really confident that he will be able to work again and have a normal life.
Shannon McCorley is Eagles Hope administrative assistant.
I would say about 70% of the people we serve are enrolled either Northern Arapaho or Eastern Shoshone. And I think it's because of lack of resources out there. So a lot of them want to come to town where there's more employment and more stuff to do, basically. It's awesome to see a lot of people that have gotten their kids back and have been able to find permanent housing, employment, vehicles, and seeing them out in the community. So at any time, I would say we have a waiting list of about 75 people.
Tremaine Thunder is a Northern Arapaho reentry client and was able to stay at Eagles Hope.
Things happened in my body. I got in a bad car accident, you know, and it broke me, really. Literally, it broke me, you know.
Thunder says the assistance he's received, especially from Terry Smith, has been a lifeline. Due to his bad heart and his medical condition, it was challenging finding services.
This is a blessing for our people, and I'm glad this reentry is here, you know.
The Northern Arapaho Reentry Program also works with the Doya Natsu Healing Center. Kelly Webb is the executive director of the Health Center, which is the culturally based substance use and behavioral health program for the Eastern Shoshone tribe.
Everything we do here is culturally based. So even when we're talking about brain science or other Western kinds of models, we put it back into the Shoshone medicine wheel and talk about it holistically. So we do a lot of holistic health services. We also have an office in Riverton, and that's how we have collaboration with Terry.
Here again is Northern Arapaho Reentry Program Administrator Terry Smith.
I want my clients to get a healthy life back. If they didn't have it before, to get it now. As long as they have hope and they work hard and they're accountable for what they've done, like they can have a beautiful life.
This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Oregon, Washington, Northwest tribes, and environmental groups will resume their lawsuit against the federal government for its Snake River dams. 2 years ago, these groups made an historic deal with the Biden administration to reinvest in endangered Columbia River salmon runs. It paused court battles for 5 years while the federal government was supposed to work with tribes to help fish recover, but also fill the irrigation and electrical needs fielded by the dams. The intention of the pause would be to work out a plan to allow the four lower Snake River dams to be breached. Trump pulled out of the deal in a memo calling it radical environmentalism that would, quote, be devastating for the region. Now the three-decade-long legal battle will resume. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield said, quote, the federal government has put salmon and steelhead on the brink of extinction and once again broken promises to tribal partners. Extinction is not an option. Oregon will return to court to hold the federal government accountable and ensure these iconic fish runs have a future, end quote.
When the city of Portland made the controversial decision to grant oil company Zenith Energy a new land use permit in 2022, there were a lot of stipulations. Zenith had to phase out crude oil, reduce its storage tank capacity, and stop operating at a local asphalt refinery. Recent comments from the city attorney indicate the city doesn't think it can enforce any of those conditions, and maybe they never did. City Attorney Robert Taylor says the city can't enforce the conditions in the land use statement, but the Department of Environmental Quality can. He says Portland could also take back their franchise agreement with Zenith based on the conditions not being met. That agreement lets Zenith use the public rights of way in their business. Portland is being sued by environmental groups over their decision to grant a new land use statement to Zenith earlier this year. They say the city didn't give the public enough opportunity to weigh in. That lawsuit is still in its early stages. The question right now is where the suit should be heard, county court or the state's Land Use Board of Appeals.
The Trump administration has long promoted aggressive policies that make conservation difficult, enabling easier logging, drilling, and mining. Now Interior Secretary Doug Burgum wants to cancel a public land management rule that had made conservation a priority. The rule was a major part of President Biden's efforts to refocus the Bureau of Land Management. That office facilitates recreational and other use on about 10% of public lands. The rule, bitterly opposed by industry and agricultural groups, allowed public property to be leased for restoration in the same way that oil companies lease land for drilling. Some states, including North Dakota, where Burgum served as its governor before joining Trump's cabinet, filed a lawsuit to block the rule. Trump wants to increase energy production from federal government land holdings, which are concentrated in western states including Alaska, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Interior officials have said the Biden rule hurt people who depend on public lands for their livelihoods and imposed unneeded restrictions, and no conservation leases were actually issued under that rule. Burgum says the rule potentially blocked energy and mineral production, logging, grazing, and even recreation on hundreds of thousands of acres. While the Bureau previously issued leases for conservation purposes in limited cases, it never had a dedicated program for that purpose. The rule also promoted the designation of areas of critical environmental concern, a special status that can restrict development. It's given to land with historic or cultural significance, or that's important for wildlife conservation. The BLM regulates publicly owned underground mineral reserves across more than 1 million square miles. It has a history of industry-friendly policies. The pending publication on Burgum's proposal will kick off a 60-day public comment period.
Over the past 25 years, Portland residents have congregated near the chimney at Chapman Elementary School in Northwest Portland to birdwatch. The school's brick chimney has long been a popular nesting site for Vaux swifts. migrating twice yearly from South and Central America to nest in the Pacific Northwest. Last fall, volunteers noticed fewer vox swifts returning to the popular nesting site. And the Bird Alliance of Oregon says it detected no swifts at the school's chimney at all during their spring migration. This has led to speculation on whether the birds will continue to use the school's chimney, which was built in 1923. Joe Liebesite with the Bird Alliance of Oregon said, quote, "We need to go look in the chimney at some point and see if there are any obstructions in there," end quote. The vox swifts continue to use other chimneys in the area, and locals continue to monitor Chapman School and await the birds' return.
Locally, the Broadway Bridge will close for 6 months beginning Saturday, October 13th, as part of its lift deck replacement project. That's according to a Multnomah County announcement this Wednesday. All cars, trucks, buses, and streetcars will be redirected beginning tomorrow. The south sidewalk of the Broadway Bridge will remain open to pedestrians and cyclists throughout construction. Replacing the deck of the bridge's movable sections, or lift spans, will include the removal of streetcar tracks from drivable surfaces and the replacement of support beams with concrete-filled steel. Streetcar tracks will be replaced before reopening. The Broadway Bridge is expected once again to welcome Portland traffic in April 2026.
It's official. The Portland Trailblazers have been sold to billionaire Tom Dundon, owner of the Carolina Hurricanes hockey team. The new owners say they intend to keep the basketball team in Portland. Dundon bought the team from the estate of Paul Allen, the Microsoft co-founder who first acquired the team in 1988. The sale still needs approval from the NBA Board of Governors. Oregon Live reports the price could be more than $4 billion. The Blazers are celebrating the return of All-Star point guard Damian Lillard this weekend as well, with a rally at Pine